If you're interested in starting a family while living with narcolepsy, this podcast is for you. How might you manage medications or symptoms during pregnancy? And what about adoption? I'm super excited about today's episode because we have an incredible panel with so much real life experience and insights to share, including people with narcolepsy who have already walked this journey, alongside an amazing clinician, Dr. Anne Marie Morris. Diana Anderson lives with narcolepsy type 2 and is the mother of a 4-year-old son. She also works full-time in physician assistant education. Emily Barker is a scientist living with narcolepsy with cataplexy and is the mom of 3 boys. Emily is also a co-facilitator for the Wake Up Narcolepsy Pregnancy and Parenting Peer Support Group. Ashley Nutter is the mother of 3 children and a person living with narcolepsy with cataplexy. Ashley also has her master's in education community agency counseling. Katie Williamson is a mother of 1 daughter and a web designer living with narcolepsy with cataplexy. Michelle Zagardo is a photographer and teacher living with narcolepsy with cataplexy and the mother of a 6-month-old daughter. Dr. Anne Marie Morris is a board-certified and fellowship-trained pediatric neurologist specializing in sleep medicine at Geisinger Health Systems in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Project Sleep's podcast. Project Sleep is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and advocating for sleep health, sleep equity, and sleep disorders. I'm your host, Julie Flygar. We're so glad you're here as we work together towards making sleep cool. On this podcast, all guests express their own opinions. While medical diagnoses and treatment options are discussed for educational purposes, this information should not be taken as medical advice. Each person's experience is so unique, which is why it's so important to always consult your own medical team when making decisions about your own health. If you haven't done so yet, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a Project Sleep podcast episode. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a rating or review wherever you listen so that we can reach more listeners and raise more awareness. The Narcolepsy Nerd Alert series invites listeners to dive deeper into specific topics relevant to living with narcolepsy. For more on this topic, please check out our corresponding toolkit, available for free on our website to download, print, and share. The link to the toolkit and other Narcolepsy Nerd Alert topics is in the show notes, or you can go to project-sleep.com. Hello, everybody. Just to go over the agenda today, we're going to be talking about preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum because, man, pregnancy is a long journey. I've learned a lot already in preparing for this. We are also going to be talking about adoption throughout that as well. I just wanted to start with this because I feel like this is a question a lot of people ask. If I have narcolepsy, could I have a child with narcolepsy? So we asked Anne Marie to put together kind of like what we know about that question right now.
Sure. And I think it's a very appropriate thing in regards to the conversation that we're having in regards to preconception, because this is something that typically does weigh heavily on the minds of individuals who have narcolepsy and sometimes comes from not only the mom, but the father as well, depending on who actually is the carrier of the risk gene and then whether or not they have narcolepsy. So when we're talking about narcolepsy, many times people will ask whether or not this is something that my child can inherit. And so when we're talking about inheritance, we typically are talking about kind of Mendelian inheritance. What does that mean? I have a certain characteristic. There's a gene that my child will get, and therefore they will have that characteristic. Now, although in narcolepsy, there is a specific gene, this gene is really just a risk gene, meaning that 25% of the general population carries this gene, but they don't have narcolepsy. When we look at individuals who have narcolepsy type 1, about 95 to 99% of them will carry this gene. And then about 30 to 40% of individuals with narcolepsy type 2 will carry this gene. What gene am I talking about? It's HLA-DQB10602. So because of this, most cases of narcolepsy are actually sporadic, meaning that they randomly occur. They tend not to be a familial pattern. However, we do recognize that when we do see it occurring in a familial pattern, that it tends to be a first-degree relative who may be affected. And so when you look at this, the frequency of first-degree relatives being affected is about 2 to 5%. However, this relative risk, when studied, has varied across different ethnic populations, which we don't fully understand. And so when there was a study done in Hong Kong, it demonstrated that this first-degree relative risk was about 85 times as likely, versus when you're looking at the Czech or German or Japanese, those risks are lower, with as low as 7 times as likely in the Japanese. Again, this risk is related to likely this HLA inheritance And again, is not your traditional Mendelian, I have it, my child has a 50% chance, et cetera, to have it. It really is just kind of stratifying those risks.
So I just have to ask, because I thought I'd heard something like someone say that your chance of having a kid with narcolepsy, if you have type 1 narcolepsy with cataplexy and you have the HLA gene, would be like 1 in 100. Is that?
Yep, that's about accurate.
Okay. And I think we will talk a little bit more about that later as well. And our panelists, as far as how they've thought about that too. Or Ashley, I remember you had a story about that.
Yes, my son is all over the place with his sleep habits and has a lot of the symptoms that narcolepsy falls under. He has lots of night terrors. He gets paralyzed in his sleep, things like that at such a young age. And I do think sometimes that he may be genetically predispositioned to have it. But at the same time, I'm confident that because I have it and because my husband and I are kind of on top of it, that he has the best support ever if it does kind of turn into narcolepsy. And we're just kind of keeping an eye on it. I was hoping that he wouldn't have it, but you just never know.
Yeah, and you would be a great support system. I love that. So Anne Marie, Dr. Morris, tell us a little bit about what people should think about as far as, you know, who should be on their team.
Sure. So when we're talking about taking care of a family who there is a member who has narcolepsy, it is really important to make this a team dynamic. So very frequently, you'll hear me say in different types of settings that I always want the patient to be the captain of the ship and I want to be the first mate. So in this particular scenario, I'm going to use a sports illustration and say, we want the all-star team to be able to help mom. And so mom really should be the captain of the team. So she's the one who should be really kind of calling the shots, but using the rest of the team to help be well-informed about the decisions that would be important for her. Now with that, mom's partner or other support person should also be intimately involved, making sure they're equally well-educated about risks and benefits that may impact the mother as well as the baby in terms of the journey, in terms of preconception, the actual pregnancy, and then postpartum. Thinking about not only that immediate postpartum, but really the fact that you now have someone who you're going to be taking care of for the next 18 to 21 years. The sleep doctor should be very much heavily involved in regards to educating on what are the options in regard to narcolepsy management, including both detailed conversations about pharmaceutical uses, but as well as different behavioral strategies that can be applied or augmented during these periods. The obstetric doctor or equivalent pregnancy or birthing support should be involved. There should be very, very open communication between the primary provider managing the narcolepsy symptoms and the person who's primarily managing the pregnancy to ensure that there's a very clear understanding of what the expectations are and what is the reasoning behind the decisions of using or not using certain strategies to manage the narcolepsy. Finally, in some pregnancies, there may also be the involvement of another specialized obstetric doctor called a maternal fetal medicine doctor. These sometimes are also referred to as the high-risk doctor. These doctors are specialty trained to be able to take care of individuals who may have certain medical conditions or high-risk pregnancy conditions that may impact the length of pregnancy, the health of the mother, or the health of the infant. And so it is important to be able to incorporate all of those key stakeholders in the conversation to ensure that all of the concerns are being addressed and that there's not a conflict of interest or information that's being presented to the patient. So that this way they can feel very secure during their period of considering pregnancy, becoming pregnant, and then the delivery. So when you're talking about the approach to this, I do think that it's so, so critical to maintain patient empowerment by encouraging shared decision-making. This should not be a unilateral conversation where the provider is only dictating that there's one option and that's it. Pregnancy is not a one-size-fits-all. In fact, narcolepsy alone, we know, is not a one-size-fits-all. So when we are adding in additional layers, we really need to make sure we're tailoring these decisions to the person in front of us. And so with that, some of the things that you can feel empowered with when you're considering getting pregnant or having children is really thinking about these questions to ask your doctor. Number one, do my medications impact my birth control? Maybe perhaps you're not ready for pregnancy. And so you want to be sure that you're doing the right thing in protecting yourself from pregnancy. And there are certain medications that can reduce the efficacy of certain birth controls. What are the risks of medication that I'm on if I do get pregnant? Does this risk differ by trimester? Recognizing that pregnancy is not a fixed date and that there's different risks associated between the first trimester, second trimester, or third trimester. And what are the risks for my baby during breastfeeding? So after I deliver, do I still have to have concerns or considerations about the medications I'm on? Or is it something that I could just start quickly right afterwards? What the doctor may ask you specifically is, do you want to be off your medications for your pregnancy? This is an important question that I hope many providers are asking, because frequently what we encounter when we look at this is that the response typically is saying, you need to be off medications. And so what needs to really occur is, do you want to be off medications and can we discuss what the risk benefits are? It also is important when you're asking the patient about, do you want to be off medications, that you're asking them not only about their narcolepsy symptoms, but physically and mentally, how do you think you'll be able to cope once you're off of medication? Recognizing that when we're talking about pregnancy, we're not talking about a few weeks. Very frequently, we may be talking about 2 to 3 years for a person. The preconception period sometimes can be as long as one plus years, depending on how quickly a person gets pregnant. The pregnancy itself is about 10 months or 40 weeks. And then the postpartum period when a person is breastfeeding very frequently can be up to 12 months to 2 years long. And so recognizing that there can be significant implications by being off the medications for those periods of time. And then do you want to consider other medications or behavioral strategies to manage your symptoms? Perhaps you're on medications that really aren't the best choice or best option available, but maybe there's other medications or lower doses of the current medication you're on that may help in reducing the risk or perceived risk associated with it, that may allow you to have a more optimal journey during pregnancy than being off medications altogether.
Well, I feel like this is like one of those Instagram videos or TikTok videos where it says, this is how it should go. Now we want to hear how does it really go?
Yes.
This is our ideal. This is our hope for the future, is what I'd say. And thank you, Anne-Marie, for putting these questions together. And we can't wait to have them in the toolkit as well. So now, panelists, let's hear preconception. How did this experience go? Were these questions the kind of questions and conversations that you were having? Anyone eager to dive in?
Yes, especially because you mentioned the maternal fetal medicine specialist, because I have a lot of complications on top of having narcolepsy. So I have always seen maternal fetal medicine specialist with all of my pregnancies. And unfortunately, I go almost every single week just to make sure other things are okay. And with that in mind, a lot of talk about narcolepsy kind of gets put on the back burner because they're more focused on just the health of the baby, just my physical self, and some of my other health issues, such as thrombocytosis, which is blood clotting, and cervical issues and things like that. So when it came to asking about what to do now that I'm pregnant, or if anything's wrong because I've been on medication for a really long time, wasn't expecting it, I kind of got a lot of, you know, shrugged shoulders and kind of doctors that would skip over that. And perhaps they didn't know, perhaps they just didn't want to add any more to my plate because we have so many other things going on. But those questions are so great to have. And again, like Julie said, I wish it kind of went that way.
And I wouldn't be surprised if one of the comments that may have been stated to you, and I don't know this to be facts, is let's focus on your medical issues. And narcolepsy, again, I think we all recognize as this silent suffering, even though there are very obvious symptoms to it. But I would not be surprised if the comments are, let's focus on your medical issues and we'll take care of we'll worry about the narcolepsy later. And so I just invite you to respond to that if you feel comfortable, because I do think that that's unfortunately a very common thing when women do get pregnant or are experiencing another medical issue, is that that becomes deprioritized and this optional consideration in terms of how this affects me as an overall individual.
And that is exactly how it felt in there. I don't know if that was word for word, but almost word for word. And I'm sitting there kind of like, this is a medical issue too. This impacts my life daily. This is just as important as a lot of other things, but unfortunately, some people don't see it that way.
Lots to talk about. I know it, Michelle.
Yeah. So I'll just outline a little bit of what Daryl and I went through. We used ovulation strips to test for ovulation so that I didn't have to stop medication prematurely. I had a goal of stopping my Xyrem. However, that was not successful. And I think that there was this idea that I had that it was virtuous to be unmedicated during pregnancy, but it was not realistic for me. And I think what was virtuous was really doing the thing that was best for my family. So I did try to stop Xyrem unsuccessfully and made the decision with my husband and with my neurologist to go back on it. And Daryl was crucial in making this decision because we both had to be okay with the risk that we were exposing our baby to. So he read papers, I read papers. We had a joint meeting with my neurologist. And once we made that decision, we went to my obstetrician and told her, this is what we're doing. And we didn't really leave any gray area for her to question it. I did work a little bit with a maternal fetal medicine doctor, not because of narcolepsy, but you know, there were all hands on deck. And so this was really important for the whole preconception period because it took us about a year to conceive, and doing that without medication would have been brutal for me.
I also can share a little. I love, Dr. Morse, that you are promoting a model like this. I think that definitely is the ideal, and especially for the mom-to-be to be the captain of the team, and for the sleep doc to be approaching this with questions rather than merely advising to be off of meds. And that's what I was advised, and I kind of was willing to accept that at the time. But like Michelle mentioned, it seemed so crazy to me to, and we were seeing a fertility specialist and had no idea how long conception would take and to be off of meds when more than half of the days we may not have any idea whether pregnancy was a possibility, didn't feel sustainable. And so we decided with the help of the neurologist that we were working with, to basically, I was taking Xyrem and I would stay on Xyrem, and I did reduce my dose when pregnancy was a possibility. And then at the time of a positive pregnancy test is when I stopped taking Xyrem. That was our approach for all three of our children. And I'll get into it more when we talk more about the experience of pregnancy unmedicated, but it was interesting how my experience was different. I think my symptoms changed, but also my environment changed so much. And so from pregnancy to pregnancy, my response to being unmedicated was definitely varied and would change the way that I would go forward were we to conceive again.
And I think you highlight a really important point that the preconception period can vary so much from person to person. And there's so many additional stressors and things that a person is experiencing that can only layer on additional potential psychiatric comorbidity of depression and despair, anxiety, and then you have your uncontrolled symptoms of narcolepsy that are going to make you feel even more helpless and vulnerable. And so there is innate dangers there that add on. And then when you become pregnant, how much of that is maternal depression, postpartum depression, versus I feel helpless and despair because of the fact that I have a medical condition that's making it more difficult for me to be the mom I want to be. And that is, I think, a part of that conversation, because I think some of the pieces I keep hearing is that there's almost like this feeling of guilt of me putting me first. And that should be abandoned. There's no other chronic medical or psychiatric disease where an obstetrician would say you should feel guilty for wanting to take care of your medical self. We would be saying instead, we need to ensure mom is healthy because mom's health is baby's health. And so I do think that that is a bit of flipping the paradigm. And again, moving away from the stigma of invisibility and really making sure that we're putting our patients first and our persons first, right? So I appreciate the stories that you guys are sharing with us.
Diana, did you want to share a little bit about your preconception?
Yeah, so mine, I think, was a little bit different in the fact that my husband and I had just gotten married and about 6 months prior. And, you know, I was diagnosed a couple of months before we decided to start trying to have a baby. And the only thing that was really brought up during my sleep visit was, you know, oh, you're going to try to get pregnant. Okay, you need to stop modafinil, you know, a month before. So that, you know, I was kind of like, okay, so I can't take anything. And they were like, no. And so then my OBGYN, they knew that I had narcolepsy, that that was on the diagnosis on my chart, but nothing was really said about it to me. And part of that is me not asking, but also I didn't know really how to ask. I thought more so that like my sleep specialist was supposed to take care of that. And every time that I had been to the OB, it was more so of like, okay, your sleep doctor is controlling that, right? So it was, you know, even though I have a healthcare background, it was still confusing to know who I was supposed to go to. And not that either of them were wrong in any way. It was more of the lack of information that I had as a patient as a whole. So I discontinued the modafinil, and then it didn't take us very long to get pregnant. So that's kind of my story. It's a little bit different from everybody else's, but once again, it was just not having the information that I could have really benefited from during those preconception visits.
Yeah. And I feel like, Diana, you'd also said that when we talked about this before, that this idea sort of that you were sort of, you're still so new to the diagnosis, you know? And so the idea of like going off, you're like, well, can you share that? Like, you're kind of
I had just been diagnosed. So I had been living with narcolepsy for 10 years, right, before I got diagnosed. So at that point, the medication, I was on it. I didn't notice a whole lot of a difference. So I was like, well, guess I'll just come off it. Like I live most of my life without it. So I'll just come off of it and everything will be fine. You know, it'll just be like normal. Not knowing that pregnancy is a whole new ball game. You know, you hear about it, but until you experience it, it's like, oh, that's what they're talking about. So that was just, and my husband was just like, okay, if you think that's best, you know, you're in the healthcare field. And I'm like, well, I am, but still, you know, I've never been pregnant. So it was definitely not a hard decision for me to come off of the medication because I didn't first notice a whole lot of difference. And then also it was so new to me that I just didn't know.
So Katie, at this point in your journey, you know, making a decision to go to the adoption route, how did you make that decision? Tell us.
I was diagnosed with narcolepsy at age 29 and like with a really fast onset, like Emily, and I was diagnosed fairly quickly. And I have narcolepsy with cataplexy, and I have very severe cataplexy. And part of the nail in the coffin was my cataplexy. I tried to do the Avadel study and I had to go off my other meds, and I made it like 3 days, and my cataplexy is so severe that I was falling. I couldn't function. So just the thought of even if I stayed on my meds, I didn't know like what could happen with my cataplexy. And so that scared me because it's just so severe. So basically that was a really big part of it, was just my cataplexy. And so to be honest, like we didn't even like really go down the route. My husband's sister is adopted, and we've always liked the idea of adoption, so it was kind of like we were okay with that. And my husband is a type 1 diabetic, and so we also didn't like the idea of what if our child is diabetic and had narcolepsy. So that sounded like not a fun combo. So that was kind of how we made the decision.
Thank you so much for sharing. To the pregnancy, because there's just so much to get to. Walk us through a little bit of this, Dr. Morris.
Sure. So one thing, just in hearing Katie describe her journey of getting the decision, I think one person that I may have failed to potentially include or consider, especially nowadays in that team, especially when there's that heavy concern that you're describing about what is the risk for my child, even though we can give statistics, would be potentially considering to include a genetics counselor. Because they may be able to have more of those detailed conversations about what the risks are, and then what are the avenues that may potentially mitigate some of those risks. So sometimes there's options in regards to utilizing IVF with some genetic profiling that could potentially help in alleviating some of those concerns. So that literally is just giving some additional thoughts on the fly as I'm just hearing and thinking about some of my approaches in other genetically susceptible conditions. And so I just wanted to kind of share that. So when we're talking about medications during pregnancy, I think first and foremost, it's really important to highlight, how do we know what the potential risks are during pregnancy? And so the majority of the data that we have, in fact, doesn't typically come from humans. It typically is coming from animal models. And the reason for that is because the data that we're able to collect from humans generally is based on observational data. What I mean is a woman gets pregnant, she was on the medication either intentionally or unintentionally. So she was on a medication maybe for another reason, narcolepsy, or potentially maybe if you're talking about a stimulant, ADHD, and then they get pregnant. Or perhaps they did have one of these conversations with their doctor and then we are able to follow them forward. There are some pharmaceutical companies who have made specific registries for their drugs so that they can collect that data forward. The reason why there's not more stringent trials looking at this is because it's unethical. We can't randomize women who are getting pregnant to continue your medication or not. That clearly would be an ethical red flag. So instead, the approach typically is using animal models and applying these medications in animal models and then seeing what happens in regards to ability to get pregnant, the outcomes of the pregnancy, meaning are there any changes in the fetus or any changes in the mother? And then what does the delivery and baby look like afterwards? And so some of the things that we're going to review here are some of the outcomes that we've seen from those animal models. And so when you're talking about sodium oxybate or oxybate therapy in general, animal studies have not demonstrated any evidence of teratogenicity. What does that word mean? It means that it has not caused any major malformations, any fetal outcomes. Now, there's limited data from pregnant women exposed in the first trimester, and there is a suggestion that there is a possibility of there being increased risk of spontaneous abortion. Now, with that said, there hasn't been very, very detailed studies looking at whether or not pregnancy itself in narcolepsy is any different. There have been some case control trials that have occurred of looking at narcolepsy against individuals without narcolepsy and seeing if there's any significant difference in signal. But again, these are still limited data sets. And then when looking at pregnant patients during second and third trimester, again, there was no major malformation or toxicity seen with sodium oxybate. And I think Emily will be able to talk a little bit later too about some of the great work she's done in the postpartum period and a relationship in terms of lactation. When you're talking about wake-promoting agents, the wake-promoting agents, examples of that would be modafinil, armodafinil, things like solriamfetol or pitolisant. Now, most of the wake-promoting agents data that we have is really more so from modafinil and armodafinil because they're much older drugs that there's a ton more data on. And so intrauterine growth restriction and spontaneous abortion or miscarriage have been reported with modafinil and armodafinil. And then some animal studies have demonstrated this embryo-fetal toxicity and lethality, meaning that in utero death. Now, with this said, when we look at the study designs again, when you're looking at animal model study designs, it is important to make the specific point that the dosing that is used is sometimes 10, 15, 20, 40 times the dosing that we would be using for humans in terms of looking at it milligram per kilogram, so weight-based dosing. And so it is important to make those distinctions. And many times we're doing those very, very high doses to, again, look for, is it possible that there could be an adverse outcome in a birthing situation? Stimulants can cause vasoconstriction. And so when you're thinking about vasoconstriction, meaning that the blood vessels tighten down, we always worry about how that may affect the placenta, which is the main source of oxygen and nutrition for the baby. And so if the blood vessels kind of constrict, that could compromise oxygen and nutrition going to the baby. And so when you're talking about stimulants, you are considering your methylphenidates and your amphetamines. When you're looking at methylphenidates, there is some published studies and post-marketing reports that are basically insufficient to inform any major drug association with major birth defects, miscarriages, or adverse pregnancy-related outcomes. Based on the animal data, again, there is the potential that it could cause fetal harm. A similar consideration with amphetamines.
And Dr. Morris, I feel like, you know, I've heard you say something so beautiful about thinking about risks and benefits. And I know you said it a little bit, but, you know, you just shared some of what we know so far. But in the broader picture, you know, like, what are some of the risks of not going off of medication?
Sure. So I think number one, as I mentioned earlier, there really aren't any other medical conditions or psychiatric conditions where there's this mandate that all patients should be off of medication. In fact, when you look at ACOG, which is the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, very frequently when they're publishing their guidelines on disease states, they have not only recommendations on medications that potentially may be the least harmful during pregnancy, but generally are stating you need to have a detailed counseling session with your women who are of reproductive age about when they want to get pregnant, not wanting to get pregnant, and then what does pregnancy look like? And really prioritizing the overall wellness of the mother and making sure we're not putting that secondary. Now, when we're talking about women with narcolepsy, I think it's extraordinarily important to really uncover what is the burden of disease. And so I think Katie had said it extraordinarily well. Her fear and her experience of when she was withdrawing from medications put her at risk of self-injury. You put that same situation in a woman who's pregnant, and there's innate risk of if you fall while you're pregnant, you can cause placental abruption, which means that that breaks the placenta away from where it's supposed to be, compromising nutrition and oxygen to the baby and really causing significant neonatal harm. And so it is important for us to think about if you have someone who has untreated narcolepsy and they're having severe excessive daytime sleepiness, which is compromising their reaction time or psychomotor vigilance, or severe cataplexy, which is causing them to fall, automatic behaviors, doing things that they're unaware of and putting themselves at risk, you are doing them a disservice and you're doing that baby a disservice. And so those risks are very real, not only during pregnancy, but then also in the postpartum period. Women universally, we experience excessive daytime sleepiness and sleep deprivation related to pregnancy. And the reality is that SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, the highest risk period is with a parent who is sleep deprived, who is falling asleep inappropriately in situations that can put that baby at risk. And so falling asleep in a chair and the baby falling down. So these are the real transparent conversations we need to have of not just suck it up and deal with your sleepiness and cataplexy, and this is an invisible illness, but really taking a look at what is the burden of this disease and how do we make sure we're alleviating that? So we're providing women the opportunity to truly enjoy pregnancy and not make these decisions of, is pregnancy right for me? Or maybe I'll only do it once, because I think that's unfair. I think that's an innate bias that we're implementing onto our patients without even giving them the option to have a chance to choose.
All right, again, that's how it's supposed to go. How did it go, guys?
Well stated, Dr. Morse. You need to be educating clinicians, I hope. I hope that's a plan down the road. Yes, I feel kind of like, well, I mean, I had my diagnosis for years, but what Diana said kind of resonated with me, just like not realizing what my role should be in advocating, or I mean, opening that as an option, I guess, being on medication. And so, like I mentioned, I had 3 pregnancies and went off medication at the time of conception. With my first, I was actually somewhat surprised. I thought that I would be going back to square one, and I ended up feeling better than I thought that I would, and was able to supplement a lot with naps and felt like I was able to manage that fairly well. With my second, my first 2 children were 20 months apart. And so I had a young toddler during pregnancy. And I mean, I hardly remember much about it. I know it was exhausting for years, actually, because I was off meds through breastfeeding with those first 2 as well. It was like 36 months. And then I will mention that with my third, I did the same thing. But I mean, what Dr. Morse was saying about risk for falls and psychomotor vigilance, I mean, there were times that my husband and I were like, what are we doing? I remember one particular instance when it's interesting how my cataplexy triggers also have changed with the new emotions of motherhood, and where like elation and laughter was always my biggest symptom. Like, this makes my kids sound bad. I have wonderful children, but when they are a little bit defiant and like kind of, it surprises me. I think it surprises me, and that gets my cataplexy. So I just remember one night when one of my children was not staying in bed. And it was just like the last straw. I remember throwing down an envelope and then just like collapsing to the floor. And it could have been an injury to my head. And I was in the second or third trimester with my third. And that was the moment where I was like, if we did this again, I don't know that I should be off meds. We need to make this more of a conversation. And similarly with the driving and drowsiness, it was a lot of stopping on my 20-minute commute for naps, or arriving and just like immediately reclining and taking a nap and waking up and being, and like wondering what route I had taken to work, you know, like, I mean, that's not safe for myself. It's not safe for other individuals on the road or for the fetus. So I just really appreciate this model that Dr. Morse is promoting. And I think that it's more common in other disease states, like you say. So that's my experience.
And I think you highlight a lot, like, so when this actually is studied, right, when we survey women who have narcolepsy and have experienced pregnancy, and we ask them, what have they done? There are women who have stayed on their medication. And in fact, when they've compared those women to women who took off their medication, there was no major differences in terms of the pregnancy outcomes, the modes of delivery, how the baby did, or anything else. Now, with that said, the common behavioral strategies that then are employed contribute to other burdens in the quality of life, right? So many of them were experiencing kind of maybe sleep elongation. So they're having longer hours of sleep at night, or as you mentioned, increased napping throughout the day. But frequently, they'll also describe that they discontinued working or discontinued driving. And so now it's shifting the burden from not just being on the individual, but also across the family unit, which of course is fair, but how necessary is it in every single situation? And how are we taking away from the individual empowerment of feeling as though that they can be autonomous and independent? And I think that's really important because I feel as though as a provider, I very frequently encounter patients who are so worried about quote unquote achieving the normal. And I like to encourage them of that. I take care of doctors and nurses and teachers and police officers who have narcolepsy. And you are going to be able to do all those great things. I have families who they have kids and they go on to do these great things. But then when rubber hits the road, we take it away from them. And as you described, for years at a time. And I do think that that's just such an important thing that we have to just continue to resonate with one another and to utilize as a part of, as a patient, advocating for yourself to your provider. Because if your provider's not asking the right questions, sometimes you can demand that. And sometimes it does take the patient demand for provider habits to change. And sometimes our provider habits are based purely out of ignorance of not recognizing we're not doing the job well.
So glad we're having this discussion. Of course, we'll have the toolkit after, which will be very helpful with these questions. Michelle, I feel like you had a really different experience. You want to share?
Sure. So I was diagnosed with narcolepsy 5 years ago, and we knew we wanted to have kids. We were also making a move to the New York City area. So I made it a priority to find a neurologist who specialized in pregnancy. Now, I also am very aware that that is not the norm, that a provider like mine is not available to everybody. But we were able to take advantage of that. And he really spearheaded my care throughout the entire period of preconception and pregnancy, really. And collaborating with Daryl and making sure that we were all on the same page. And I was able to take those decisions to my obstetrician, and she was able and really just said, like, here's what we've decided. You're welcome. You are not really even part of this conversation right now. Not in a bad way, but in a way that, like, you know, this isn't a threat to you or your practice, or you don't have to worry about prescribing these meds because someone else is taking responsibility for that.
So, but you decided to stay on medicine?
Oh, yes. Yes. Thank you for that. Yes. Yes. So I stayed on Xyrem throughout the entirety of my pregnancy and preconception. So at a slightly lower dose, but at a dose that was still therapeutic for me and was able to manage my symptoms with naps. And between naps and Xyrem. And then I did want to add on top of what Dr. Morse has talked about, in preparing for pregnancy, we also prepared for me to be working part-time. And that is a privilege that I had that I know that a lot of people don't have and was important because I couldn't hold down a full-time job during pregnancy.
And Michelle, how did your pregnancy, I know Emily said that the first one, she actually kind of felt better than she, but so did you feel like, you know, better?
I don't feel like my narcolepsy changed a lot during pregnancy. I felt like a superhuman after Hadley was born, which we can talk about in a little bit, but I was same sort of sleep schedule, same sort of nap schedule, same cataplexy triggers. And it was really not until Hadley was born that things really just changed for the better, but we'll see how long that lasts.
Ashley?
Yes. Thank you for sharing, Michelle and Emily. I really have a lot of similarities with Emily's share, actually. This is actually my fourth pregnancy. My first pregnancy, unfortunately, didn't make it. I had a miscarriage during class, of all things, grad class, and I had to have a DNC because I was a little far along in the pregnancy. And when I got pregnant with my son, I had intrauterine growth restriction, which doctor just mentioned, and small for gestational age, had problems with my placenta, amniotic fluid was low, just all the things. So being on any kind of medication was just like out of the picture. But also similar to Michelle, with my first successful pregnancy with my son, I had just a burst of energy. I don't know where it came from. It just took over and I was just able to manage taking care of him and having naps and the breastfeed. So I had been on off of medication for so long. And my daughter came as a surprise. And I was kind of thinking that around that time that maybe I'll get back on medication because I was starting to get a little bit out of whack. I have really bad cataplexy as well. So I was really concerned about that, especially with driving. Sometimes when it rained, I would just, my mind would just go blank and I wouldn't even know where I was. And when I had my, when I was found out I was pregnant with my daughter, and I brought that up to my doctor about narcolepsy kind of coming back a little bit, being a little bit stronger, they were really hesitant about putting me on any medication because of everything that happened with my first pregnancy, because I already had a lot of the really extreme side effects without even being on medication. So I did that. I ended up having a seizure with her right after she was born and other kind of small febrile seizures, but also they weren't really sure the cause of it because, as some of us know, cataplexy can kind of look like a seizure sometimes. It can kind of seem like someone's like having a fit, but they could really just be having a cataplexic episode. Still no rule on what happened there, but it did kind of take me back a little bit, and she definitely slowed me down, caused me to only breastfeed for a year. I breastfeed for 18 months with my son because I wasn't on any medication with her. I stuck it out for a year. I don't know if I'll be able to do that again without any medication. It was quite difficult. Just napping in between, sleeping in the car with the recline. It was just really difficult. And I was really excited to get back on medication again. When I was done breastfeeding her after a year, I was like, I'm through with it, I'm done. But after I got back on medication for some reason, I don't know, probably not because of the medication, my cataplexy just was really terrible and I had to stop working. It really affected my writing, my just ability to just be present. And I was in my residency for counseling at that time. So it was really kind of a bummer for me. And I started doing other things, talk later about my Empower Project Hot Nerd Club. And then all of a sudden I was pregnant again after being on medication for so long. And there were some concerns because of the first pregnancy that medication might not be the best route, but or may have affected the baby, but so far, so good. I'm still not on any medication right now because they don't recommend it with everything that happened with me. But it's been really encouraging to hear about the stories from you all about being on medication. And I'm looking forward to hearing about breastfeeding with medication and all of those things. So that's been my journey so far. And we're just waiting on to see what happens with this one.
Katie, do you want to share about the adoption process and talking about narcolepsy? How did that go? As usual, interacting with any group of people that might not be familiar with narcolepsy is always interesting. So,
yeah. So first off, the adoption process for everyone is going to look different. My husband and I decided to do a local infant adoption within the state of Missouri. Obviously, you can adopt internationally. And then you can also adopt out of state as well. And so there's a lot of different agencies and, you learn a lot. Like now looking back at the whole process, like we really liked the adoption agency that we worked with. And like looking back, I feel we made the right decision because it took a long time. It took over 2 years and the pandemic didn't help move things along. Because we started our process to adopt, like we looked at agencies and then started filling out all of the paperwork in guess, and it was like like January of 2018. So, or maybe 2019, I don't know. It took a long time, basically. And so with the agency that we worked with, you submit an application and then you do a home study, which, and I also didn't mention, there's also private adoption, which you still need to have a home study. And so that's like a big piece of the puzzle. And each state does it differently. But basically, a home study is something where a social worker will come into your home and give you the green light to say, yes, you can. Like this home should be a safe and stable home to bring a child into. And so you give them, like, they do background checks and fingerprinting and, you know, all sorts of different things. And like you have to have a medical exam by a primary care physician. And so when I was filling out my paperwork, I said I had narcolepsy. And no one was that concerned about it, but they weren't familiar with it. And so their question was, well, are you going to be okay to parent? And this was the agency that I worked with. And so they just had me go, my sleep medicine doctor wrote a note basically, and it was pretty short and sweet, like you can parent with narcolepsy. And so we just submitted that and that was fine. And then when it came down to actually, so we met our daughter's birth mother and that never came into the discussion. I don't remember we have to make a profile book. I might've said that I had narcolepsy, but I didn't call it out. So we didn't make a big deal about it, but yeah, it's definitely a big process. And it didn't hold us back at all. It was just making sure that whatever paperwork I needed. And my sleep doctor is wonderful, but she was kind of like, what do you need? Like, cause she'd never had to do it before. So now should they have something on file?
Yeah. And then we'll have to connect people with you if they have questions.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Thank you, Katie. Diana, did you want to share about your pregnancy?
Sure. So mine, you know, I came off of the medication. We got pregnant relatively quickly, within a couple of months, and I stayed unmedicated throughout the pregnancy. I worked in surgery at the time, and it gave me, I would say that, you know, I was still able to do my job full time. However, after our morning cases, before afternoon clinic, I would sometimes go into my office, which just conveniently had an exam table in my office with the computer. So I would go in there during lunch and take a snoozer. And then I would come out for afternoon clinic and I would feel refreshed for a short period of time. And the surgeon I was working with at the time, he was very accommodating for that. In the operating room, you know, it's, to me, it is a job where I don't have cataplexy. So as far as the excessive daytime sleepiness, like when you are operating on someone, I never had that where I had a sudden sleep attack. I think my adrenaline was just going too much, you know, knowing that patient's, you know, life was in my hands in our hands. And so I just kind of got through it. But afterwards, I really felt the effects, done for the rest of the day, just so tired. I would say the one thing was brain fog. So like everybody has, they call pregnancy brain, right? Where everybody is kind of, you know, oh, I forget that. Oh, it's pregnancy brain. But I had that, I feel like, to the 10th power or maybe 20th power, if that's a thing. And, you know, aside from that, I slept a lot on any opportunity I could get to sleep. I slept during pregnancy and I was never asked at all by my OB, like how's your narcolepsy doing? It was because in my mind, you know, they didn't have a choice. And so, you know, and I guess the sleep specialist was just kind of like, okay, well, we'll see when you're ready to get back on medication. So, you know, it was a little bit different than everybody else's, but like I said, you know, I don't have the cataplexy. So I think that is a little bit different.
Well said. Let's move on to postpartum. And Emily, we're going to have you kick it off with some of your amazing research.
I'd just like to share a little bit of how I became involved with the research. just because it's funny how paths come together. But so I studied chemistry for both my undergraduate and graduate degree. So as a chemist, I was familiar with the pharmacology of sodium oxybate, which was the main medication that I was taking, and as advised. And I think I don't want to like put blame on my doctors. It will be great if doctors ask more questions, but I do like take responsibility for the decisions that we made and said, we want to minimize risk. We're going to try to cope without medications. And so I did stay off during breastfeeding for my first two children, but kind of always had this question because, I mean, we who take Xyrem know it's not in the bloodstream for long. Like you wake up and you are awake. And it was just unknown how that pattern was in the breast milk. But it's funny, I actually worked in a lab where we studied these small hydrocarbon molecules, and I had a lab mate who worked on gamma hydroxybutyrate, which is oxybate. So I knew we had all the tools, but I was raising a family and engaged in grad school. And I'm like, I want to do this eventually. So it was at my first patient conference that I attended with Narcolepsy Network, where there was a jazz booth, and I approached them and said, I'd really like to do this research, not knowing what they would say. And they connected me with one of their medical affairs people who were at the conference, and she was just like glowing. She's like, you want to do what? And so she knew a clinician at Brown University, Dr. Katie Sharkey, who had also expressed interest in doing a similar study. So we were able to become connected, which has ended up being led to more fruitful collaborations. And so I'm going to share some of the research that we did and our findings for sodium oxybate excretion in breast milk. So specific for sodium oxybate, this is just an overview of how our study was designed, and I don't want to slog through a lot of data, but it's a small study. There's so little research in this area, and it would be wonderful if future studies looked at larger populations. We had two participants and studied a total of three pregnancies. Both women had narcolepsy with cataplexy diagnosed in young adulthood, and we were able to test in both women, or in all three of the pregnancies, one low dose and then a higher dose. And so we were ranging anywhere from 2.25 grams twice a night to 4.5 grams twice per night. And then we had women collect their milk every 4 hours following their dosing. We intentionally made our sample collection, you know, when we imagined women would be breastfeeding, and we didn't anticipate that women would want to breastfeed from 0 to 4 hours while they're on their sodium oxybate and extremely sedated. And we quantified oxybate by a method called gas chromatography, mass spectrometry. So this is how our dosing and collection went. So SO, sodium oxybate dose. So this is for one woman who basically did two consecutive nights. The first night was on 3 grams of sodium oxybate. Second night was on 4.5 grams. And so we collected prior to her taking her first dose, and then collected at 4 hours after that, before she took her second dose, because we really wanted to see, like, what's the likelihood of exposure? You know, most women would wonder, can I breastfeed between doses? And then following the second dose, we sampled every 4 hours until that evening when she took her higher dose, and then did the same thing for night two and continued into the following morning. So some of our overall findings: sodium oxybate is excreted in human milk. Increased sodium oxybate dose does result in increased concentrations in the milk. Sodium oxybate levels are elevated over baseline in between nighttime doses and 4 hours following the second dose, but those levels appear to return to baseline by 6 hours following the second dose of sodium oxybate. And so 6 hours was the earliest time point that we observed a return to baseline. And that was corroborated by findings of Bussardot, who published a study in one additional patient. And they, I'm not sure how they achieved this, but they were collecting milk like every 30 minutes. And that the pharmacokinetics in breast milk was very similar to in blood, as far as the time frame for being cleared from the breast milk. And they observed return to baseline at 5 hours. So we never captured a measurement that early. But with the studies together, it appears that it's likely that sodium oxybate levels return to baseline, you know, anywhere from 5, 6, 7 hours after that second dose. And so what are the implications of this? How does this help somebody who's wanting to go back on sodium oxybate and breastfeed their infant? Breastfeeding women receiving sodium oxybate therapy may be able to schedule their nursing to avoid potential GHB exposure to the infant through the milk. And so if you're taking your second dose at 3 a.m., by 8 or 9 a.m., that may be cleared from the milk. Of course, like I said, this is a small study and there's still some questions that remain are, you know, like, because your body's making milk all of that time, would it be necessary, for instance, to express that milk and not use it if you really wanted to avoid exposing the infant? And so those are some of the discussion points in our paper that maybe a woman would want to discard her morning milk and then resume breastfeeding at the next feeding. But all of these things can be a discussion with your physician and your OB. And I think it will be wonderful if there's more work in this area, but our feeling was that any data in an area where there's nothing has got to be helpful. So I mentioned Dr. Sharkey, who was wonderful to work with. And then at Case Western Reserve, where I'm based, I had great support for doing the quantification of oxybate in milk.
That's so much information. So exciting. But Diana, before you head out, tell us a little bit about, you know, how your experience was postpartum.
After Logan was born, I was breastfeeding. And, you know, it was quite the battle because at the time he was allergic to dairy and we didn't know that he was allergic to dairy. And so he was basically not sleeping, you know, because I was breastfeeding him. I didn't know the allergy at the time. He was spitting up a lot, not sleeping, fussing a lot. And I was not on medication. I was advised to continue to not take medication during lactation as well. So one night I remember my husband and I switched off at night. And so it was my turn to kind of just hold Logan in the living room and feed him and then pump. And so it was exhausting. It was like 2 or 3 in the morning. And I remember just breastfeeding him, sitting on the couch, holding him. And then my husband comes out, I guess, of the room. I don't know how much longer later, but he woke me up and Logan had kind of like drifted out of my arm and his head was like kind of off my arm into the pillows of the couch. And thank God he was okay, but I just felt absolutely terrible. I thought, how could I let my guard down like this? How could I do that to a human? And, you know, it could have ended very, very badly and it didn't. And, you know, that kind of was the realization at that point. And I said, this is it. I said, you know what? I said, he's having trouble with feedings anyway. And, you know, he can get nutrition from formula. I just don't feel safe doing this anymore. And that was kind of the eye opener for me. You know, he could have been smothered and I couldn't do it anymore. So I stopped breastfeeding as a result and got back on medication so that I could be awake and be there for him. And obviously my symptoms of narcolepsy did improve once I got back on some medication, but it was a very scary experience.
Thank you for sharing that, Diana. I know it must be really tough to share that, but it's just so important because that's the reality, I think, of what so many people probably go through, right? So,
yeah. And that's part of why I'm doing this. I don't want anybody to have to feel that way and have to go through that. So I think this, like, once again, I hope that all of the pregnant women that have narcolepsy, and even if they don't have narcolepsy, if they tune into this and just listen, I mean, it's just so full of information. So thank you for letting me be involved in this. And I'm sorry that I have to hop off for another engagement.
All right. Thanks, Diana.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Before we get to some of the support resources that are out there, can people share a little bit about their postpartum experience? Ashley?
Sure. So with postpartum with my son, it was pretty good. I did have a scare kind of similar to Diana one night where he kind of rolled off me into the bed in between my husband and I, but we were able to catch it quickly and it kind of like caught me. But that was really the only scare. I overproduced, so like I pumped like 20 ounces every 3 hours. If people know what breastfeeding is like, it's like just, that's just a lot of milk. I ended up donating some of it because it was just so much. I did not have that with my daughter. and she refused to anything but breast milk. She had acid reflux real bad, and it was really the only thing that she could keep down. So I had to exclusively pump with her, as I had so many issues after my seizure and having another toddler while dealing with her. It was quite challenging. I was really kind of happy and inspired when Emily shared about the study and how long medications last inside the breast milk, because I think that's really helpful to know. That would have been really useful with my daughter, who was a little bit harder to breastfeed. I could go really long stretches during the day where I didn't have to pump or anything, and then just do it like every 6 hours with my son. Like, because it was every 3 hours I would get engorged, I probably would have to modify that a little bit. But again, that's why we're here and all this great information. Hoping that my postpartum with this is kind of similar to Michelle, and I get that burst of energy that I had with my son where things were just a-okay. That's what I'm hoping for. I'm setting good vibes that way and hoping that it rubs off. But that was pretty much it.
I'm going to go ahead because I have two creatures who are quiet right now. Ashley, I am sending you all of the hormones. I really hope that you have what I have. So I was able to stop Xyrem immediately after Hadley was born and breastfeed really easily. I was an overproducer like Ashley, and which came with some challenges, and it was really nice to be able to not have to worry about Xyrem at all. There are three things that I want to tell you guys that really helped us during pregnancy and preparing for postpartum, and I think that really set us up for success. The first thing is therapy. Daryl and I started couples counseling when we were 8 months pregnant with a counselor who specialized in postpartum and chronic illness. Now, I understand that that combination might not be available to you, but it helped us to know that somebody else was on our team, and that when Daryl became sleep deprived, which he had never experienced before, we would have somebody who we could, you know, call on if we needed help with communication. I remember having a little bit of resentment towards him initially that, you know, Hadley was only feeding from me. He would give her a bottle, but every now and then, but, you know, there were constant demands for me. We were able to talk that out really easily and move through it and come up with ways for him to support me. So that was the first thing. The second thing is having a lactation consultant who we knew about and we had met with before Hadley was born and who helped us in our journey after she was born. And then the last thing is that we got rid of about 70% of the things in our house before Hadley was born. And the reason for this is because I'm responsible for most of the things in our house, and I knew that I was not going to have the time, energy, or attention to really take care of those things after Hadley was born. And I wanted to prioritize time with her and with Daryl. And so if you follow me on Instagram, you know that my house is immaculate almost all the time. And the reason for that is because there is nothing in it. Hadley has toys. She's not without, but you know, all of her clothes can fit in one small basket from Target. All of her toys can fit in one small basket from Target. We're obviously going to experience growing pains as we, you know, get, as she gets older, as grandparents want to give her things. But starting from that baseline really helped us not have to worry about taking care of everything in addition to having to manage sleepiness.
Such important points. Anne Marie, I know you're going to have to possibly hop off soon. Is there any last advice that you might want to share?
I think that one of the big take-home pieces would be, you've heard from multiple women who have done this journey, and they've done it successfully in both approaches of through adoption as well as through having their own children, and some of them successfully even with more than one. And so you can see that they're in each of these journeys, they've been personalized, and they do describe areas where they've felt as though that more knowledge would have been more power. So I do hope that you take some of the information and utilize that in your own journey and feel empowered and activated in your own patient journey to make sure that you are demanding the care that you feel you deserve. And although that sometimes sounds unappealing because it sounds like you're being a mean patient, the reality is that you're the one who is experiencing this journey, and all of us in the provider side are here really to support you. And if we're not doing the right level of care or not answering the questions that you need answered, then it is up to you to be able to feel comfortable and confident to ask these questions. And so I'm very hopeful that this information has been helpful to people, whether it's you as the woman who is planning on getting pregnant or as a partner for your spouse or significant other, because I do think all of the questions and a lot of the comments that have been made today can only lead to more successful steps forward. And then the other piece that I would say is just as a field, I would make the plea that can we do better? Can we do better communicating? Can we do better studying this? Can we do better in empowering our patients to be able to have the lives that they want? And I think that we still have a lot of steps forward, but I think if we are able to lock elbows, arm in arm, moving forward, I think those steps are going to be ones that we can get through more quickly.
Thank you, Dr. Morris. You're the best. We're so grateful for you. And so, Katie, did you want to share at all about what's it like to have a new one in your life and dealing with your narcolepsy and how that has been?
Yeah. So Michelle spent 9 months preparing, and actually Michelle and I had like talked before, and Michelle like made a bunch of meals. I was very impressed by her, but we didn't know when we were going to have a child come into our lives. And with adoption in like a perfect scenario, I guess you'd have 3 months notice. We had like 6 hours notice. We got a call on a Saturday morning and we went to the hospital that like afternoon and met our baby. And she was in the NICU for a week. And that ended up being a blessing because she was a little baby. And so they wanted to make sure she was eating okay and gaining weight. And it ended up being a blessing in disguise. And we learned so much in the NICU. So we were really grateful for that. And then I could like get some things ready. And really when you have a baby come into your house, you don't need that much for them, at least an infant, you know. And my husband and I had been like talking about this and for 2 years, but until you actually know it's going to happen, it's really hard to prepare, I guess. And so we had talked about it. My husband's awesome and we both work from home and we're really lucky for that. And so he got up at night and fed her because she's all formula fed. So he would get up in the middle of the night to feed her. And I'm kind of a morning person. And so he would feed her in the middle of the night and I would feed her in the morning. And our schedules just, it kind of worked out. And I mean, he was sleep deprived for a little bit, but we're also really lucky because, I don't know, 2.5 months in, she's basically slept through the night every time. Like she sleeps 12 hours. So she's a good baby most of the time. Yeah, so she's been sleeping through the night. So, I mean, I definitely get tired and because I'm hanging out with her most of the time during the day. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm so tired. And I do have to have my husband like, hey, you need to like hang out with her because I have to go take a nap. And I don't know, I feel like my cataplexy hasn't been too terrible. But Emily, like you said, I definitely feel like it could like change too, like my triggers. Down the road too, I definitely could see how that could happen. So, I mean, overall, it's been, I actually maybe would say it's been better than expected. I mean, I guess to an extent, like just jumping into everything, like without like thinking, overthinking it too much has been good, so.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that she stays a good sleeper. So I think we should move to talk about some of the support resources that are out there, because this is not the only thing that you can do. And I know we're getting late and I'm super sorry, but I knew this was going to be a long conversation, but it's an important one. So Emily, do you want to share a little bit about the support group?
I will try not to be long-winded, and all of this will be in the toolkit materials. But if you like this format of like sharing, talking, asking questions about experiences, then you might be interested in this Pregnancy and Parenting with Narcolepsy online support group. So we run under Wake Up Narcolepsy through a partnership with Hey Peers. So you can find us at heypeers.com and subscribe to Wake Up Narcolepsy, where you'll find our meetings. We meet on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern time. However, we're not meeting all of the time. We have I co-facilitate with another wonderful young mother, and we take turns, and basically we'll meet for 6 weeks, and then we take a 3-week break, and then 6 weeks on and a 3-week break. And so we've been running for over 3 years. A lot of the women have been with us for a while. I feel like it's really a beautiful experience. Michelle can attest. She's been with us for a while, and there's always, you know, core people who are there frequently. And I think it makes it a really welcoming environment for first timers who come often. But I gain so much more than I give to this group by attending from week to week.
Thank you so much, Emily, for all that you've been doing. This kind of work is absolutely invaluable and so super important. So I just can't thank you enough for helping to lead this group. And we will definitely continue to be sharing about it. Here are some additional resources as well. The Hypersomnia Foundation has incredible information about parenthood and pregnancy, along with also a whole section of their website about birth control, menstruation, and menopause. So please check out the Hypersomnia Foundation's resources. Emily, you mentioned this Facebook group called Pregnant People with Narcolepsy and Mothers. So that's a great resource. And also you'd mentioned this NIH's LACMED, which is helps to give information about drugs and medication and lactation.
So yeah, that's, and then you just plug in your medication and it digests all of the research for you. So it'll be a great resource to go through yourself and take to your doctor for whatever meds you're taking.
And of course, your wonderful paper about the levels. And so just a reminder, everybody, we have these great organizations and in the US and wonderful organizations around the world. And we will, of course, include that in the toolkit. But in closing today, I just want to ask those of you that are still with us, if you have one closing piece of advice, one thing that you would say to someone that is thinking about taking your journey either with pregnancy or with adoption and narcolepsy, what would be your one piece of advice?
I would say just to be kind and patient with yourself during the process, because every pregnancy is just so different and everyone experiences pregnancy in their own way. And I think we brush the surface of mom guilt, but I feel like that just kind of carries on with you from preconception to postpartum to teenage years, and having this neurological condition that won't go away doesn't make it easier. So try to take it easy on yourself and accept help from others. I think that's a big one as well.
I think what I would say is that I hope that this Nerd Alert has given you hope if you want to be a parent, and that if you're committed to becoming a parent, there are a lot of ways to do it and ways to do it and take your health into consideration, and that there's an awesome community of people here to support you, whatever your journey looks like.
And to kind of piggyback on what Michelle said, I just thought if adoption sounds like a good path for your family, just explore it and go for it. Don't be afraid. It can take time. So just go for it.
Yeah, similar. I was going to say it can be done. I think that was kind of why I became more involved after we grew our family and went through a lot of the challenges and found ways to make it a little easier. And I would be in settings where I could tell there were many women who still had that as a big question mark. Like, can I really do this? Could we really grow our family? Reaching out if you'd like to get more support, you'll get a better feeling for the richness that can come and how with growing your family, and that there are strategies to make it feasible and even enjoyable, even with the limitations of narcolepsy.
Thank you guys so much. And thank you for giving so much of your time, especially as parents and moms. And thank you to everyone for tuning in. And we just can't wait to hear more stories and continue to connect on this topic. So we'll see you again soon.
The Project Sleep podcast is produced by Carver Sound Productions. For more information on podcast production services, visit carversoundproductions.com.